This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk about a military training program right in our own backyard. It's called the Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps, or JROTC, and it teaches lessons to more than 500,000 students in approximately 3,400 high schools nationwide. We take a look at the state of freedom in the United States and around the world. Sarah Rapucci from Freedom House joins us to talk about their annual report, Freedom in the World, and in particular, their recent report, Democracy Under Siege. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. The Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps, or JROTC, is a federal program sponsored by the U.S. Armed Forces in high schools across the nation. It currently teaches its lessons to more than 500,000 students in approximately 3,400 high schools. In recent years, the military and its supporters have promoted the idea of a significant increase in the number of high schools with JROTC. One proposal even calls for expanding up to 6,000. Because of this, one nonprofit in San Diego decided it was time to examine the textbooks used in JROTC classes to see exactly what they're teaching. The Project on Youth and Non-Military Opportunities, or Project YANO, is a counter-recruitment organization founded in 1984. It released its findings of the textbooks in early July. Reviewers have backgrounds in classroom teaching or education activism, or special knowledge of subjects that JROTC claims to address, including civil rights, violence prevention, leadership methods, and world history. Reviewer team members included current and retired high school teachers, military veterans, and a documentary film producer. Joining us to talk about this report and JROTC in general is Rick Jankow, a co-founder and board member of Project YANO. Rick worked for 34 years as the organization's full-time program coordinator. He's researched and organized around the issues of military recruiting, high school, junior ROTC, and the general militarization of K-12 schools. Rick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Rick, tell us in a nutshell, what is the militarization of youth and what's wrong with it?
In basic terms, I would say it's a situation where young people are militarized by conditioning them to see military values and behavior as normal and an acceptable model for civilian society. That's done many different ways, but that's sort of the basic way I would define it. And the reason it's wrong is that the values taught by the military system emphasize obedience to authority and the use of violence to resolve conflict, which is the opposite of what we should be teaching young people if we want them to think critically and uphold democratic ideals.
Now, the JROTC website says, and I'm quoting, that it's one of the largest character development and citizenship programs for youth in the world. What promises does JROTC make to young people?
I'll list several. Realize there are problems with all of these promises, though. One thing they promise is leadership skills, and values education. They promise self-discipline. They promise to teach lessons in history and social studies. They claim that it provides academic improvement for the cadets. They claim that it improves eligibility for college acceptance. They say that it will provide access to college scholarships. Those are sort of the main promises that one can hear from them.
Would you say that students who are attracted to some of those promises, do they join ROTC of their own free will most of the time?
I'm not sure how often it's voluntary. Yes, some do join because they want to be in the program. They see it as a way to advance their prospects for joining the military later on. But we've also seen plenty of evidence of schools involuntarily placing students in the program. And the reason for that is mostly because federal law requires a minimum enrollment level in order for a school to have the program. And so placing students in involuntarily is one way to meet that minimum requirement.
And let's just be clear, this is for both boys and girls in school.
That's true.
Now, why does the military and some supporters want to expand JROTC programs in high schools?
Well, I think it's mostly because of the recruitment function. They publicly will promise that JROTC is not a recruiting program. This is said by instructors in the program and school officials. But testimony in Congress has labeled it as the military's most effective in-school recruiting program. And according to the different military branches that sponsor JROTC, between 30% and 40% of students who finish multiple years in the program eventually do enter the military. And the textbooks are full of recruitment information telling students, you know, how to join the military. So it's really quite disingenuous for anybody to claim it's not a recruiting program.
And I was interested to learn and a bit surprised that JROTC instructs students on the use of weapons. Is that accurate?
It's often offered as a voluntary option. Students who join JROTC would have to choose to be on the rifle team. But marksmanship training is done with high-powered lead pellet rifles and shooting ranges that are frequently located in the schools. Some school shootings, in fact, have been carried out by current or former JROTC cadets. And in the case of the Parkland, Florida shooting, the shooter was actually a former JROTC cadet who learned his marksmanship in the JROTC program there.
Interesting that we don't hear about that in the news coverage of these mass shootings.
We hear very little of it.
Oh, Rick, tell us about Project YANO and why it formed.
It formed in 1984 to address the socioeconomic factors that make low-income youth especially vulnerable to recruitment and militarization, and also for the purpose of facilitating greater youth activism around the issues that directly affect them. And it was formed with the involvement of military veterans, where we see ourselves as sort of an educational organization that can help young people make more educated decisions about their futures. And we realize that when it comes to military recruitment, the burden falls disproportionately on low-income youth and youth of color.
Rick, have you encountered any legal issues when you do counter-recruitment and school demilitarization organizing?
Yes, there are several ways that legal issues come up. There is, for example, a legal issue around schools giving the military's aptitude test, the ASVAB, which stands for Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. Recruiters basically go to the counseling staff and convince them that they can give this free test to their students to help them evaluate their career prospects. And the test results in recruiters receiving not only contact information, but also very personal information on the students who take the test. And some schools have even made it mandatory that an entire grade of students take the test. The federal Privacy Act that affects the release of pupil records, we believe, is violated by the test. And we wish that it could be litigated, but so far we've had no opportunity for that because we haven't really found the ideal plaintiff to file a lawsuit. But we worked with the Rutgers Center for Law and Justice to research the issue, and they produced a best practices memo that explains how the test violates privacy and is actually a nice piece for distributing to counseling staff at schools. Another issue has been junior ROTC, and what comes up there is there's a federal statute that requires disestablishment of a JROTC unit when the minimum enrollment is not met, and the minimum enrollment is 100 students or 10% of the student body. We've seen many cases of JROTC units that fall below the minimum requirement, but they continue to operate in the school. And here, where we're based in San Diego, we actually help members of the Latinx community pressure a principal into removing a unit for under enrollment. But it took quite a bit of effort to do that. The principal just did not want to let go. We're also aware of another school in the county here that got rid of it voluntarily. And usually when that happens, the students are the ones who've actually determined that it was going to leave because they stop enrolling in it or they even boycott it. What we would like to see is activists pay attention to that and investigate enrollment numbers, because they could do something similar if they can document that the federal law has been violated when the unit is allowed to survive without having the minimum enrollment. And in fact, we worked with the National Lawyers Guild Military Law Task Force on that issue, and the task force produced a very nice memorandum on the statute, and it's another way that students and parents and others could pursue the issue in their local school.
Hmm. Was Kathy Gilbert involved in that?
She was involved to the extent of referring us to an attorney in Albuquerque, I think it was, who actually is the one who did the work.
Great. Okay. We love the Military Law Task Force. Rick, I understand that you actually advised on a lawsuit in the 1980s that resulted in establishing the right of counter-recruitment activists to have equal access to schools as do military recruiters. Can you tell us about that case?
Yes, that is the other instance where legal issues have come up, and in fact, it's probably the most frequent issue. What happened is in the early 1980s, a San Diego organization was banned from placing ads in student newspapers, and the organization went to federal court seeking an injunction. The argument they made was based on the First and 14th Amendments and utilized the Supreme Court government forum analysis. The organization lost at the district court level, but then appealed, and the Ninth Circuit basically reversed the district court. And the ruling held that the subject of military service is controversial in nature, not primarily economic, and that once a forum on such a controversial issue is created by a school, it must give equal access to those giving opposite views on the subject. There were, I think, a total of 5 lawsuits during the 1980s, all of which were eventually decided in favor of counter-recruitment groups. The scope of access granted differed in each case, but they all were positive results. And it turned out that the Ninth Circuit ruling established the broadest range for equal access. And we've used it to basically force school districts to grant access, and other groups have used it as well. The ACLU has cited it frequently when they have assisted organizations that have had access issues, and in most cases, by citing those cases, those particular lawsuits, but especially the Ninth Circuit, a local grassroots group can prevail. And we've tried to make ourselves in Project Yano available to advise them on ways to do that. The problem with that is that there is a tendency by some groups to want to litigate again. And based on the climate, the political climate, especially in at the Supreme Court level, we would discourage further litigation anytime in the foreseeable future. The military tried to intervene in our case in San Diego. They did intervene in a case in Atlanta, and they stated that they did so primarily because then they could offer resources for appeal to the Supreme Court that a school district might not have. It turned out that they did not really help defeat groups from getting access in those cases. But they also made it clear that they're going to be looking for future similar cases and then seek to intervene in those.
The reason to discourage litigation, especially now, is that we don't want to create bad law and undo all the work that you did in that wonderful victory from the 80s.
That's exactly the point, yes.
Rick, let's turn to the recent Project Yano textbook report. I understand reviewers had several concerns. One was that the textbooks failed to acknowledge that members of the military are often sent to fight non-defensive wars of choice, frequently for the purpose of advancing U.S. economic and political power. In that instance, what false assumption about joining the military does it reinforce?
One motivation for many who enlist is the assumption that our military is only a defensive force that protects our freedoms. And the textbooks reinforce that myth with the kinds of lessons that you described, telling students basically, this is how you'll be able to support freedom in your country and defend us from aggression and from enemies abroad. And it's basically reinforcing that myth that is what you achieve when you join the military. In fact, it's not. In fact, you'd be sent to places to fight wars of aggression.
For the most part, is the material contained in these textbooks up to date? And also, do different branches of the military contribute to these books?
The most of the material is way out of date. The Army, in fact, during the last school year, was still using a 2005 version of their core textbooks for their remote learning program. And yes, every branch determines its own curriculum. They all either produce the books themselves or they hire writers and textbook publishers to create the material for them. And then sometimes they will take existing standard textbooks and customize them for JROTC. So each military branch can brand it according to their own characteristics.
I know this is a complex analysis, but how, in general, do the JROTC textbooks compare to standard school books?
Well, for one thing, standard school books don't contain entire sections teaching students how to join the military. They don't teach military values and military leadership. One of our reviewers, who's a recently retired social studies teacher, actually was able to compare the contents of a standard civics textbook with content that JROTC had borrowed from it and modified. And what she found was that there were questions that had been posed in the original standard book to encourage critical thinking by students, And those questions were turned instead into declarative statements by JROTC. So they weren't really asking students to think critically about a particular question. They were just telling them what to think.
And that dovetails with something you said earlier about JROTC instilling respect for authority as well as other qualities that are taught in the military. Did your reviewers find examples of racism in the JROTC textbooks?
Oh, yes. One textbook referred to the genocide waged against Native peoples in the U.S. and in the Americas as the quote-unquote Indian problem. It also quoted a general who called them savages. Another book quoted a U.S. admiral who used a racist stereotype aimed at Asians. He referred to the cunning of a female Viet Cong. Another book had a section on the Middle East, and it dismissively and incorrectly claimed that most, and they used the term Arabic, which is incorrect, that's a language, but the book claimed that most Arabic countries are under some form of Islamic Sharia law. And then it compared that to the many more countries that are based on the European Civil Code. There are other examples of that, especially in the treatment of Native Americans in the wars that were waged against them in the 1800s. It's not unusual. We saw some of those examples of racism and misinformation about history in a review of the books that we did back in the late 1990s. So it was not a total shock, at least to me, that we found more of that.
Are the teachers, the instructors who use these textbooks, are they part of the military, or are they the high school, part of the high school faculty?
They're both. They're employed by the school district, and the school district's required to give them all the benefits that are given to a regular teacher. But the military has to vet them, and they must be retired officers or retired commissioned officers. So that's a basic part of the statute that authorizes the JROTC program. They rarely have teaching credentials in the subjects that they're teaching other than military-related topics. And this has led to a lot of criticism and challenges from community activists, but school districts seem to be willing to look the other way when it's pointed out that these are instructors that are teaching subjects that they are not really qualified to teach. And the military actually recognized it was a potential problem for them when a few years ago they began to require at a minimum an associate arts degree, because there were JROTC instructors who had no college degree who were teaching these subjects in the classroom. So now at least they have to have an AA, but that doesn't mean that they have credentials to teach history or civics or social studies.
Rick, how is this textbook review project, how is the report going to be used in terms of organizing and for activist purposes?
Well, we have a couple of goals. One is that we want to bring it to the attention of journalists and op-ed writers who focus on education issues. And secondly, we want to offer it to activists as a possible tool they could use to challenge the establishment of new JROTC units in their local schools. It's a very daunting challenge to get rid of an existing unit, and in fact we suggest looking for other things to do about existing units, like try to eliminate involuntary enrollment. But it is possible to challenge a proposal to bring in the program for the first time, and it can be done so by challenging whether or not the curriculum is being vetted by the school district. That is one tool the report is that could be used for that purpose.
I'm curious, do you have any anecdotal or other information about parents' knowledge of involuntary enrollment and any reactions by families?
Yes. When we joined a coalition to demand restrictions on JROTC and the San Diego Unified School District, one thing that happened as a result of that was parents were learning for the first time not only about the shooting ranges that existed in San Diego schools, but also that their students were being forced to attend the program. And we asked students and parents to describe to us their experiences when they found out their students were enrolled, and many of them didn't know that they could demand that their students be transferred out. And in some cases, they did request a transfer, and they were told at the local school site level that there's no room for them in other classes. And in particular, they were told that this was their PE class, basically, and PE had no room for them. So parents got quite frustrated. They joined us in protests, both outside and inside the school district headquarters, and had a powerful influence over the school board. And the school board did decide, for example, to remove shooting ranges from 11 schools. The superintendent at that time issued a directive saying that students should not be allowed to enroll in JROTC without first obtaining informed consent from both the parent and the student. But what we found was that quite often parents were just shocked. They weren't really aware of what was behind the whole thing and what they could do about it.
Rick, I think that in general this topic really screams out for more national media coverage. Most Americans would be shocked, I think, to learn about the extent of the JROTC programs and the repercussions they have.
Yeah, I think there's a particular danger that concerns me most, and that should concern not just people who are worried about the issues of war and militarism and the military-industrial complex, but it's the fact that a program like this is trying to convince students that military leadership models and values are suitable for civilian society. And that, to me, is the most dangerous feature of the military's intervention in the school system. They're trying to recruit bodies, but they're also trying to recruit minds. And they reach a lot of students who will never join the military, but who are groomed to at least think along military lines.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Rick, how can our listeners read this incredible report and learn more about Project Yano's work?
They can visit our website, which is projectyano.org. They can look us up on Facebook and Instagram. And if they check out those platforms, they can learn about some of the resources we've produced to not only help educate young people, but also to assist organizers.
Rick John Coe, it was just a pleasure to have you on. To learn about JROTC and JROTC in general, but also the textbook report and the fine work of Project Yano. We want to stay in touch, and we wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate this.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
What if you could assign a grade to countries based on how free they are? Freedom House, a nonprofit organization founded in 1941, does just that. In 1973, it began using social science analysis methods to assess the level of freedom by nation, attaching a numerical score and ranking them as free, partly free, or not free. The report, known generally as Freedom in the World, has been called the Michelin Guide to Democracy's Development and, quote, essential reading for policymakers and political leaders. The 2000 version of the report, called Democracy Under Siege, was written by Amy Slipowitz and Sarah Rapucci. They noted that the pandemic, combined with economic and physical insecurity, along with violent conflict, struck a heavy blow to defenders of democracy. It shifted the international balance, they say, in favor of tyranny. Incumbent leaders, according to the report, increasingly resorted to force when dealing with opponents, while, quote, beleaguered activists, lacking effective international support, faced heavy jail sentences, torture, or murder in many settings. Joining us today is Sarah Rapucci, Vice President of Research and Analysis at Freedom House. She oversees their flagship publications, Freedom in the World, Freedom on the Net, and Nations in Transit. Sarah advises policymakers and business leaders on democracy and human rights around the world, and her commentary has appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, BBC, and many other outlets. Sarah previously worked for Transparency International and the Global Business Initiative on Human Rights, and as an independent consultant for several NGOs and private businesses. Sarah, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Heidi.
How does the 2021 Freedom Report compare with prior years with respect to the state of global democracy?
So, global democracy is in the midst of a 15-year decline, and the year 2020 was that 15th year. So what we're seeing is a furthering of already dire conditions, and really COVID-19 was a big factor in that. We're seeing an exacerbation of a trend that we had already been seeing.
Now, I saw that the United States has a rating of free. Can you please elaborate on the different ratings and how you assess those?
Yeah, sure. So we have a methodology, and it looks at different areas of political rights and of civil liberties. So under political rights, we look at things like elections, people's political participation and opportunities there, and how well the government functions, levels of corruption. Under civil liberties, we look at the basic freedoms, speech, religion, assembly, association. We also look at the rule of law, the independence of the judiciary, and at some personal individual freedoms. And by looking at all of these different areas, we give scores for each of our 25 indicators, and we do that for every country around the world. And those scores result in a measurement that we then designate as either free, partly free, or not free.
You must review a wealth of information. What are some of the sources that you all look at?
Yeah, so like you say, it's quite a diverse range of information that we have to look at to evaluate all of these different factors. We look at publicly available information that the government publishes. We look at news reports, but we also consider a lot of in-depth reports by different nonprofit organizations that are examining different aspects of this. And we hire country experts who can consider all of these different aspects, can speak to people on the ground in different countries, and then make the final determinations.
Now, let's talk about the United States score. We already know that we're free, but there's been a general decline, as you said, over the past 15 years globally. Has the U.S. score in particular seen improvements, or is it on a par with that overall decline?
Yeah, so unfortunately, the United States has been part of this overall trend. The U.S. score has been in decline, not for 15 years, but for the past 10 years. And we've seen, we use a 100-point scale, and we've seen an 11-point drop in the U.S. score over those 10 years. And that's really quite a big drop. The U.S. has moved from being on par with countries we might think of as peers, like Germany and France, down to a level that's closer to countries of Eastern Europe, like Croatia, Romania. It's quite a dramatic drop for an established democracy.
Now, I noted on the website, I guess it was sort of the summary of the report, that so-called enemies of freedom put forth a false narrative that democracy is in decline because it's incapable, I guess, the institution of democracy, of addressing people's needs. But you say there's another reason. What is the real reason for this decline?
So, you know, the decline is being driven by a lot of different factors. And I think that people losing faith in democracy is really significant. And I think part of the reason why people are losing faith in democracy is because democratic governments are failing to deliver on their concerns. But another reason they're losing faith in democracy is that China is billing itself as a viable alternative, and it is hiding a lot of the atrocities that it is committing, while meanwhile presenting itself as having a very effective government. And there are many people who see this as inspiring and who think that maybe democracy is not the best system. We would, of course, argue that democracy is the way that helps people be more economically prosperous and more secure and safe and have what they need, but we need that messaging to get out more and for people to see real improvements in their own lives.
On a topic that I know our listeners are greatly interested in, we have to focus a bit now on President Donald Trump, who, as the report notes, presided over what I think is a rapidly accelerating decline in U.S. freedom scores. But in the, you note that it made the country an outlier among its group of seven peers. Now, what factors, and we're going to, just to let you know, focus a little bit on the last year of his presidency, but leading up to his last year, what factors under Donald Trump really drove that decline?
Yeah, so in the United States, we have a system right now that was already weak. As I mentioned, it was already in decline before Donald Trump was elected. But we did see an acceleration of the decline under Donald Trump. And in a lot of ways, that was due to various factors related to norms in the United States that were weak and that further weakened. So a situation of conflicts of interest in the administration, also an undermining of some of the checks on government power and on of abuse of power, including when Donald Trump fired inspectors general who are meant to ensure that the government is free from corruption. We also were very concerned about vocal undermining of some of our strongest institutions in this country, our judiciary, our independent media, and the ways that Donald Trump's rhetoric made people think that maybe those were not so independent or were not doing their jobs. And I suppose we'll get into the election as well.
Yes, I just want to reiterate, though, I personally thought the issue of the inspectors general, who many people in the country really may not be aware of what they do, but under Trump, he really showed a politicization of previous administrations, as far as I know, don't really interfere with the roles of Inspector General, but not Trump, of course. And when one or two came forth with examples of blatant corruption, he fired or maligned them in the media. And I think combined with the corporatization of our U.S. media, all those external factors, when colliding with someone like Donald Trump, have a disastrous impact on our overall really perception of transparency and fairness and in democratic values that we espouse on paper, at least.
Yes, and something I would add, you know, in the area of misuse of power is how frequently President Trump used the pardon and sidestepped the vetting process that has traditionally been used ahead of time to vet presidential pardons, and also to focus quite a large number of pardons on close associates and others who were involved in corruption charges. Even though the presidential pardon has certainly been misused in the past, it was much more frequent under President Trump.
In the year preceding the assault on the Capitol, there were a series of episodes that really threw the country into the global spotlight. COVID-19, I assume, being one. Can you talk about how Trump's final year really put us into a crisis mode?
Yeah, so we were watching all countries in the world and how they handled the pandemic, and especially the type of information that was coming out of the government, whether it was reliable, expert-based information, whether it was consistent so that people would know what to do. Because, of course, you know, we can remember how scary it was for all of us when we just didn't know what this virus was and how it spread and what we could do to protect ourselves. In the United States, it was definitely one of the countries that we called out for a lack of reliable information, inconsistent information at the national level versus the state level, inconsistent in different states, and a lot of misinformation that was coming straight out of the White House. President Trump presented information about the virus that wasn't true, about how it could be treated, about how it could be prevented. He did not encourage the use of masks when medical experts were saying that masks would make people safer and would help to contain the spread. And at this critical moment when people really did need leadership, what we were getting out of the federal government was a lot of confusion and lack of transparency. So that definitely laid the ground for, or I would say actually, that definitely built on a lot of the dismissal of expert advice that had already been happening in this administration before COVID, and of course built up towards the election when we had kind of the ultimate misinformation surrounding whether or not there was fraud.
Does the report, I believe it singles out most destructive act of Donald Trump while he was in office. Can you tell us what that was and why it was so destructive?
Yeah, so, you know, of course, any democracy is built on its elections, and it is extremely important, it's crucial for the people who are voting to have faith in that system. Otherwise, there's no point in them voting. And, you know, we certainly see that in many dictatorships around the world where people don't believe that their vote matters, and so they don't go out to vote. In this country, President Trump started a campaign well before the election of seeding doubt in the result, in seeding doubt in the people who administer our elections, who I will say come from both parties and actually have quite a long record of a very high degree of integrity. But President Trump was speaking regularly about the fact that there might be fraud, that we had to watch out, that it would be unclear whether the results of the election would be credible. And then, of course, when we went into the election, though, that rhetoric amped up. He was speaking about this more and more. And, of course, when the results showed that President Biden had won, that rhetoric amped up even more. And President Trump succeeded in undermining the faith of sizable percentage of the population, up to 40% of the population, who believes that there was massive fraud in this election. Meanwhile, it has been checked over and over again by representatives from both parties, and there it has been no evidence found of massive fraud.
Yes, and I thought it was interesting. You have a couple of quotes. On the heels of the Capitol riot, for example, a spokesperson from the Russian Foreign Ministry said, quote, "The events in Washington show that the U.S. electoral process is archaic, does not meet modern standards, is prone to violations." And then Zimbabwe's president said of the incident that it showed the U.S. has no moral right to punish another nation under the guise of upholding democracy. So in addition to really sowing unfair and incorrect fears of election fraud, that also had sort of a ripple effect nationally. Why should Americans care about comments like that?
So I think we should care about it for two reasons. One is, I think that many Americans take a lot of pride in our democracy. We're taught in school that we're one of the great democracies of the world. We learn that, you know, we're one of the oldest democracies, the most established. Then we come to see that we're being disparaged and even laughed at by people around the world because of what happened in the last election. But I think it's more than pride. It's also a matter of the globalized system that we're in and what it means for other countries to take our democracy less seriously. A lot of our security in this country comes from our good relations with other countries and especially with other democracies. We have mutual defense agreements with other democracies. You know, many people may have heard the concept that democracies don't go to war with each other. When there's more democracy in the world, it's safer for Americans. It's also more economically prosperous. We have more trading partners. We have more markets where we can sell our goods and where we can buy from. I think people may think of China as, well, but they're an economic power. But China's really an exception. In most cases, it's democracies that make up our loyal allies around the world and our trading partners. And when our democracy falters and we don't have the credibility to speak out on the global stage about abuses in other countries, that makes our foreign policy less effective. It gives us less leverage. And of course, you see with things like the massive increase in migration to this country, that comes from problems in the governments in Central America, where those governments are not able to address the needs of their people, and so those people are fleeing to come here. It causes direct problems on our borders. It causes problems that we have to deal with overseas, and it does make us less safe.
One aspect that also attracts people from around the globe to come to the United States is the way we proclaim to be a nation that espouses personal expression, freedom of association, First Amendment rights. How is the state of freedom of personal expression right now in this country?
So it's a very turbulent time for free expression, and that's in large part because of the internet and the new challenges that have come up as people think about free speech differently in a world where Facebook might shut down your account. But we also have one of the most vibrant media environments in the world, and it is true that our media environment has become a lot more polarized, but we still have the opportunity to speak out in both the traditional media and online very, very freely. And this is not only true now, this was true under the Trump administration. People could criticize President Trump very freely, and they did not face retaliation. So while I think there are a lot of threats to free speech in this country, a lot of concerns about whether people might be silenced for having certain views, whether it's more difficult for people from certain groups to speak out than if they're from other groups, and those are all genuine concerns. If you look at it from the global level, we still do have a very free speech and expression environment here.
And on another more positive note, the report notes that several of our institutions actually stood strong in the face of so many ongoing assaults over the last several years. Can you give an example or two?
Yeah, so I think the three big ones I would say were the judiciary, which remained very independent. You particularly saw it after the election when repeated cases were brought before the courts, before judges who were appointed by both Democratic and Republican administrations, and continued to rule independently that on the results of the election. The media that I just mentioned, which did continue to speak out very vocally about what was happening and to investigate and to bring as much information to the public as was possible. Then the third I would mention is our election administrators, who were mostly at the state level. We have an unusually decentralized election administration in this country. The fact that it's done at the state and sometimes even local level is not typical for a big democracy or a small one. Our election administrators had the opportunity to really be on the front lines of a massive national fight and were able to hold strong and to do their jobs and to certify the results of the election as they have been appointed and hired to do.
In our few remaining minutes, what does the report say that the U.S. needs to do to shore up more of its institutional safeguards, civic norms, and core values to regain its global credibility?
So definitely we need to focus on our elections. And I think there's a lot of different areas of this. One area is that we really need to end gerrymandering in this country. Gerrymandering drives a lot of the polarization that we see because the districts, the way that they are drawn, makes the primaries more important, and primary voters tend to be more extreme than the voters in a general election. But we also have massive problems, and we haven't spoken much about this, with inequality, racial inequality in this country. And I think it's really important that we expand opportunities to vote, not just because that makes for a more democratic system generally, but because it can help address a lot of the inequities we have in voting opportunities for especially people of color in this country. Another area that I would flag is the improper influence of money in our political system. Since the 2010 Supreme Court ruling, Citizens United, we have seen unlimited spending on political advertisements, and this really has furthered a situation that was already there of massive influence of money, which then has a knock-on effect in terms of who is elected, in terms of the disconnect that sometimes exists between those who are elected and the general population. So those are two areas that I would call out.
On a positive note, the report concludes that despite setbacks for freedom in 2020, democracy is remarkably resilient and has rebounded time and time again from repeated blows. On Law and Disorder, we like to share ways for listeners to get involved. Do you have any advice for those who fear the country may have a harder time now undoing histories of assaults on individual freedoms? And on that note, how can they follow your work and that of Freedom House?
I'm always optimistic. I continue to be optimistic. I think that the huge emphasis that the Biden administration has put on democracy is already having effects on our global image, on the ability of the United States to make change. Part of the benefit of democracy is that it can be self-reflective, and there are going to be mistakes, and we have made mistakes, but we can correct for them. The way that I think that all Americans and your listeners can be involved is to make sure that they do what they can, especially at the local level, for their own democracy. Get involved in your local school boards or your local city councils, whether that's running yourself or whether that's just supporting candidates, you know, helping to get out the vote. These things really genuinely do make a difference. I think it's also important to hold those who represent you accountable. If you're not happy with them, throw them out. If you want to change their policies, write them letters, be in touch with them. They want to be reelected, so they do listen to their constituents. And I think if people can express what they really need and what they want in this country, those in power are going to be forced to take action. And that's really what we need right now in this country, is to have more accountability of those in power to the people who elected them.
And how can our listeners read this wonderful report from Freedom House?
So our website is www.freedomhouse.org. All of our research and analysis is there on the website, and I hope that you will explore what we've talked about and much more.
And how can we follow you on social media?
I'm on Twitter at Sarah Rapucci, S-A-R-A-H-R-E-P-U-C-C-I.
Well, Sarah, it's been really a delight to speak with you today. We want to thank you and Freedom House for the incredible reports that you put out every year, and there are many others in addition to this Freedom Report. So listeners, please check out Freedom House. And Sarah, thank you so much for being with us on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much, Heidi.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.